The following interview was conducted by Max Borders, managing editor of TCS Daily. For more information, please visit our website at tcsdaily.com.
It's just about Earth Day 2006. It's also the 15th anniversary of the publication of Free Market Environmentalism, the book that changed the way many people look at environmental issues. Joining us today is Terry Anderson, co-author with Don Leal of the book that defined a generation of new environmentalists, a generation that is friendly to markets, to green values, and to the idea that these are not mutually exclusive. Welcome, Terry.
Great to be with you.
Word has it you have the decapitated heads of megafauna on the walls of both your home and office. Many defenders of wildlife might be repulsed if they knew this, but how, given certain property rights regimes, can hunters like you actually help their cause?
All the heads hanging in my office and on my walls at home, I shouldn't say all, but most come from Africa, where I have hunted extensively with bow and arrow. The hunting that I do there is on lands that would otherwise be occupied by Brahma cattle, lands that are barely capable of supporting even a few head, let alone many head of cattle. Those lands have been converted to wildlife lands because hunters like myself are willing to pay a fee to the private landowners to hunt on their land. This is fair chase in every sense of the word. That is, it's not shooting a cow in a corral. But what it has done is changed the incentives for landowners to provide habitat for animals that otherwise would be competing with their cattle. Not only do these animals compete well with cattle, they make the returns to the landowner much higher, and that's why this land exists. There was a very good book written by Raymond Bonner, a journalist with the New York Times, entitled At the Hand of Man. Bonner went to Africa to show how bad and evil hunting was. After being there a while, he discovered that his focus on a single animal detracted from understanding how it is that hunting and payments by hunters, or people photographing for that matter, really enhance the overall survival of not just a single population of impala or zebra, but an overall ecosystem that is home to those. So I think that hard-thinking environmentalists, clear-thinking environmentalists, see a clear link between what hunters do, or anyone who pays the fee for providing these services, does for the animals themselves.
Mm-hmm. And this, of course, is contingent on underlying property rights being in place in some way. Is that right?
Very much so. In fact, if you look at Zimbabwe, where those property rights have been undermined by a terrible regime under Robert Mugabe, you see an example of what happens when the property rights are taken away. In Zimbabwe, there were several private reserves that were flourishing with literally hundreds of thousands of acres under wildlife management by private owners in conjunction with state officials. And now that those property rights have been eroded and taken away from the owners and given really to no one other than some bureaucrats who are profiting from short-term decimation of the populations, the wildlife is disappearing. The one place that isn't happening in Zimbabwe and throughout Africa is on the lands where the local people have control of their communal lands. And I'm told by a game warden from Zimbabwe that even Mugabe's thugs won't go on to those lands because those people profiting from wildlife, from hunters like myself, are not willing to let Mugabe take their valuable asset, their land and their wildlife. So they are being protected there, and it probably isn't a pretty sight to see how it's protected, but nonetheless protected.
Well, suppose that we're convinced that property rights and markets create these incentives for protection of species or other kinds of resources. But how, to your mind, can they help keep, say, the sludge out of the air or the river or out of the ground?
in thinking about free market environmentalism, I think it's important to make the transition from the easier problems to the tougher problems in the context of property rights. And not that wildlife is an easy problem, but it's certainly easier than air. If we ask what is it that makes property rights slash market system work for wildlife, it is that we can define the space. We can rectangularly survey, or in this day and age use GPS to define a space that some individual or group has control of and can limit access to. So mm-hmm. the communal lands in Zimbabwe that I mentioned earlier are in effect owned by the community, and that's a well-defined space. They can keep people out. They can husband the resources that are held therein. And that's why it's an easier problem. Let me take the next step to a little tougher one, water. Water flows across many different boundaries, both political and private. And in that process, it's more difficult, therefore, to define who owns the water. Nonetheless, in the American West, for example, and in other parts of the world, we can define quantities of water owned by and therefore available to be extracted by the owner. That has to dovetail with downstream owners, so that if you have a superior right to my right and you're downstream from me, I have to let the water go. But throughout the West, those rights are fairly well defined. Now if we take one step further from just diverting the water to water quality, we can even define the rights in terms of quality. That is to say, you're upstream from me, I have a right to divert a bucket of water, and that bucket of water has to have certain characteristics. It can't have sludge in it, it can't have mercury in it, it can't have you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can measure the quality of my water and hold you accountable for what you put into my water. So it's tougher than wildlife, but it's doable, and it does happen. Now if we move to airsheds, and I use that term to get you thinking about areas of air that may be somewhat better defined, but certainly not as well defined as water. So we can imagine the LA Basin being an airshed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a right to clean air and I put gunk into your air, that is, suppose I light up a cigar and blow smoke in your face, it's pretty clear I've violated some rights and you can hold me accountable. However, if there are millions of automobiles spewing stuff into the air and millions of people breathing that air, it's very difficult to think of a property rights system per se.
Right.
But it isn't impossible to think of making a market that could help. And here the solution is to establish rights to the air for emission purposes. That is, I have a right to emit so many tons of SO2 into the air, and if someone wants, and the government sets that right, so it's not a perfect, pure free market, it sets that right, and then if somebody wants to enter and dump more SO2 into the air, they have to buy my right. Or if somebody would like less SO2, they can buy my right and not exercise it. That kind of tradable permit system is working very effectively for relatively well-defined airsheds like the LA Basin.
Hmm.
And now if I can just jump, maybe I'm getting ahead of you, but if I jump now to the, you know, sort of the mother of all environmental issues today, global warming, it's virtually impossible to think about how one could establish property rights to some global atmosphere and, or even some kind of tradable permit system, given that we don't have a single world government, thank heavens, that can establish these levels and allow trading.
Right. And that is the hope, is that the cap and trade systems that have worked for stuff like sulfur dioxide or particulates around in various cities might also work in a Kyoto style format for global warming, but there are just a lot of associated problems with that, I understand.
I used to be somewhat sanguine about the prospect of a cap and trade system for carbon, but I'm less so every day. For two important reasons. One is that we don't have, or three, I guess I'd say. The first is we don't have a political process whereby it's easy to set the caps. Kyoto would be that if everybody would agree.
Mm-hmm.
The second problem is that even if people agree, then we don't have any mechanism for enforcement. So if we agree and China agrees and China doesn't abide by it, what are we going to do about it? In L.A., we can take the police force in and shut the factory down because it's within the sovereign domain of the United States. But that's not so easy. And thirdly, how do we even know what's going on? How do we measure people's actions? So, for example, if I say, well, I'll pay you to plant some forest, and that will give me some credits for sequestering carbon, and then your forest burns down, or you cut some of the trees, it's an incredibly difficult monitoring process to know whether you're abiding by the contract and so on. So I'm just not very optimistic that that's a solution to global warming anymore.
Yeah. Well, overall, though, it seems that free market environmentalism is about aligning incentives and balancing both economic and environmental interests, which, if we get right down to it, are one and the same. Given what we know about incentives and of the entire regulatory edifice in the U.S., so we can come back home to the U.S. now, what would you say is the single most wrong-headed piece of environmental legislation still on the books?
Oh, that's a tough one. The single most. Boy, you're causing me to choose amongst so many evils, it's difficult to decide.
Well, give me three if that's easier.
Okay. Well, let me start with one that it certainly gets perhaps as much press as almost any, and it is the Endangered Species Act.
Okay.
Again, I'm not quite sure I'm willing to say the single most, but the Endangered Species Act is a classic example of a piece of legislation that started out with some justification, namely, we're going to stop the bald eagle from going extinct, and no one thought it was a great was a good thing to have Terry Anderson out there with his 12-gauge shotgun blasting at bald eagles. So it was easy to pass legislation that said, thou shalt not take a species. What happened with that legislation, however, is that it became a mechanism whereby people who wanted to save any species, and I mean any, even fungus, even wildflowers, even toads, even, you know, flies, could utilize this to take other people's property rights. And that is why I think this is a particularly pernicious piece of legislation. First, I don't like the idea of taking other people's property rights, but secondly, it flies in the face of getting the incentives right. If I know you're going to take my property if it harbors red-cockaded woodpeckers, an endangered species in the southeast, then I'm going to make sure in the first place there aren't any red-cockaded woodpeckers there.
Mm.
Maybe I'll do it the, as people in the West are fond of saying, the shoot, shovel, and shut up way. That's clearly illegal. But there are many things I can do short of that. I can go out and cut the trees that would be habitat to ensure that the birds don't stay. Don't even come. And the data are clear on how this happens, where it happens, and why it happens. One logger said the Endangered Species Act has taken old growth timber in the southeast and turned it into pulpwood. That is, you don't want your trees to get old enough to be habitat for red-cockaded woodpeckers, so you cut them when they're very, very young, which may not be the best thing for the forest. It may not be the most profitable, but it's better than having being told when the trees get old you can't cut them. So we have a piece of legislation aimed at saving species, but it has made species the enemy. I have a wonderful cartoon, well, actually a computer-generated picture of this gopher with an army helmet and a bazooka on his shoulder. And we have made that poor gopher the enemy of the landowner because we insist on taking landowner property rights. So that's a classic case. I guess I think that another law, not a piece of legislation per se, but a part of the court-made law, is a doctrine known as the public trust doctrine. This was a doctrine used in California to stop Los Angeles from diverting its privately owned water rights from Mono Lake and the Owens Valley. It was utilized in the effort to restore the ecosystem of Mono Lake, with the argument being that California as a state had a public trust responsibility to do this. The result is that Los Angeles had its water rights taken, but in the litigation process, which was very costly, it took more than 15 years for Los Angeles to stop diverting water. If we had simply used a market, and some of the environmentalists involved now acknowledge this, we could have purchased the water rights from LA, done it on a willing buyer, willing seller basis, made it happen more rapidly, and done away with all the acrimony and litigation costs. So there's another very pernicious kind of rule that flies in the face of getting the incentives right, and more importantly, flies in the face of improving the environment.
Mm-hmm. These are great examples. I'm sure you could go on all day.
Well, as I said, it's hard to come up with a single example because there are so many. Let me just touch on air for a moment. We look at how we deal with air pollution. In general, what we do is we use technology-based requirements so that we tell people, people with power plants, you must put scrubbers that scrub the pollutants out of the emissions before they go into the air, and they are collected in ponds and so on. We know quite well from a scientific basis that we could reduce sulfur emissions far more at a lower cost if we simply burned low sulfur Western coal. We wouldn't have to have all this expensive technology. But the incentives, once the technology is there, is to burn whatever coal is closest and cheapest, and that's high sulfur Eastern coal. That's what explains acid rain. A very ridiculous kind of regulation, ridiculous from an environmental perspective, understandable from a political one. For example, if you're Robert Byrd and your constituents are miners, you want them burning high sulfur coal. You don't care about the environment. So, we have example after example of supposedly attractive looking environmental laws. That is attractive if you're an environmentalist and you say, well, boy, we're really making those evil polluters clean up the air, resulting in higher costs, more pollution than we'd have otherwise if we simply relied on a market process.
Hey. Well, I'll ask you a final quick question, and before that, say I really appreciate your time. What do you think of this whole Crunchy Cons business?
Well, let me just give a quick response in the context of what I have called being a conservative conservationist.
Mm-hmm.
See if this doesn't get at the kind of thing that's in the book, which I will take a look at. Conservatives have long considered the environment to be their Achilles heel. When I was an advisor to then-Governor Bush, during the campaign, one of the advisors on the environment, it was very clear that the people in the political, with the political controls were not about to bring the environment up because they thought it would be a case where a conservative would have to lose to a liberal. That is, you don't really care about the environment, Governor Bush. You just care about jobs and economic activity and the environment be damned. The fact of the matter is that free market environmentalism is the perfect way to be a conservative conservationist. That is, it's conservative in that it uses markets and requires less government, but the evidence is just growing daily that free market environmentalism is the way to have conservation work. Aldo Leopold, the great conservation leader and icon for most conservationists, was fond of saying that conservation will ultimately boil down to paying the private landowner who does the public interest. And I think therein is the conservative way to think about conservation, and it's what free market environmentalism gives us. It is a way to link a conservative idea of less government with a conservation idea of a healthier environment.
Darren Anderson, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.